Well, the whole BEE story is now coming into focus closer and closer. Let me just tell you a little story. Last week, Eskom got terribly excited about the fact that Kusile finally brought the last of its 800 megawatt sets on, which takes Kusile to 4,800 megawatts. Only problem is, it was supposed to cost the country 80 billion rand. Final cost, 17 years later, 250 billion rand. Why? Well, a big chunk of that was because of BEE requirements. Gabriel, I know that's not really what we're going to be looking at, Kusile, but my goodness, it's almost like a practical implementation or reflection of what BEE is costing South Africa. And it's just extraordinary how these numbers are now adding up.
Yeah, no, it very much falls inside the budget conversation for the following simple reason. Eskom is an organ of state. If Eskom wants to, it can avoid paying BEE premiums by making a request to the Minister of Finance for an exemption under Section 3 of the Public Procurement Policy Framework Act from paying BEE premiums. It can do that. Eskom has actually done that for some contracts and has been granted exemptions after 2021, but then it stopped working. The exemption process, the minister started refusing and Eskom stopped applying. So, but the point is, if Eskom wants to, it can say to the minister, please give us exemptions from everything. And it could have done it for the whole of Kusile, the whole of Medupi. And why would that have been a good idea? Because those are extremely complicated projects. Because the parts that we needed to go into those power stations are not made here. And if you have BEE requirements, that means you have to buy from an intermediary at an extra amount rather than buy from the original manufacturer in South Korea or Japan or Europe or wherever it may be. Paying extra is not something that we can afford. It's in the national interest not to do so. So, you know, the lesson should be, let's not do that anymore. Kusile's now finally come online, but it's going to need maintenance. And where are those maintenance parts going to come from? And how much extra are we willing to pay for those maintenance parts? I think most South Africans would agree, we shouldn't be paying any extra for those parts. We should be getting those cost parts at maximum value for money. And that's only going to happen if we start applying pressure to Eskom as well as to Treasury to cut those BEE premiums out now. And this budget crisis is the right time to have this conversation.
Well, we are assuming that our tribe who are watching this watched our previous discussion on BEE premiums, but there's always new people who are coming into the BizNews family, as it were. And I think for them, if you can just unpack for us, please, what a BEE premium is and how it has become part of our law.
So it's the legal amount of an additional expense that is required by law to be paid for the same goods or services based on racial preference. Chief Procurement Officer of Treasury, who sort of oversees hundreds of billion, we could say oversees 1.2 trillion rand in annual public procurement expenditure, Willie Mathebula, has testified before the Zondo Commission about how BEE premiums work. He testified before Parliament about how they work. He's explained repeatedly. They are capped at 11.1% that for contracts over 50 million rand, and they capped at 25% for contracts under 50 million rand. So I'm not talking about illegal corruption. I'm saying legally required, you spend an extra 25% for a contract of 10 million buying something if the company that's selling it is selling exactly the same thing, but it's racially preferred. And the city of Cape Town did a maximum value for money report where it found evidence of various BEE premiums that it is being compelled to spend money on. One example I've used is traffic light controllers, the little tech that goes into the thing. It's like 70, 80,000 rand for each traffic light. And they could have bought it from the original manufacturer. Instead, they had to buy it from a BEE partner at an extra 8%. And that means there's less traffic light controllers to buy or less money left over at the end of it to do other stuff.
So we always assume that we are engaging with intelligent lay people. And as a consequence of that, the members of the BizNews community, anybody who's listening to this is going to be asking, but why? Why, if you have to purchase it through some kind of a third party, why can't you go directly to the original equipment supplier? And particularly now, and let's not talk about all the corruption that went on in Kusile, and we know that's been very well documented, but particularly now the point that you make, so you've got this massive project, which we've already overpaid for by 250 minus 80, so 180 billion rands that have gone into the debt that our children are going to have to pay off one day. So just to put that one side, now it has to be maintained. Eskom is not allowed to buy directly from, say, the Japanese supplier. There has to be someone in between who, if the contract is less than 50 million rand legally, will put their 25% on top of it. Or if it's over 50 million rand legally, will put 11% on top of it. So Eskom is now going to just pay more, which means we pay more for electricity. The question from the intelligent layperson is why?
I think one place to go for an answer is Gwen Ngwenya, who was a former colleague at the Institute of Race Relations. After that, was the head of policy at the DA, who wrote a very important piece a few years ago in Politics Web called BEE, An Eclipse of the Brain. And the case study that she focused on there was Chancellor House, the ANC investment arm, and Hitachi, and the procurement deals that went into Kusile and Medupi. What happened is that the ANC passed the BEE premium law, and then the ANC created an investment arm, and the law basically required foreign suppliers, including from Japan, they wanted to get into the market to do deals with the ANC investment arm so that they would sell to, let's say, Chancellor House, to the ANC, and an ANC would sell to the government, making a nice fat profit. And then that money would pay for the ANC to do election campaigning or to have lunch or whatever. So, I mean, the reason Ngwenya focused on that example was because the paper trail is explicit. It's not a mystery and it's not corrupt. It's not corrupt in the sense of it's against the law. It's more corrupt in the sense that apartheid was corrupt. So in apartheid, you had a system where the government said some people are not allowed to vote and some people are not allowed to have roles in government in procurement, including in procurement. People are not allowed to establish businesses in various places. Those were all ways of managing the labor market, which did create room for rent seeking. It did create room for some companies to make cream off the top. And in that sense, it was corrupt. This is corrupt in that kind of way. It is, by the way, if you go back to the 19th century, when the industrialization of Europe had gone a long ways and political scientists were starting to try and think about how government and private enterprise really intersect, the phrase rent-seeking came out of that period of analysis precisely to describe this kind of thing. Legal, what you might call corruption, but it's totally legal. It's where businesses and lawmakers have gotten together and they've made rules that make it impossible for some people to compete so that those who are inside the tent can get extra by keeping those outside of the tent at bay. It's just classic rent-seeking. And the reason I make that point is when you ask why, you know, there's, in a way, there's nothing special about our situation. On the other hand, there is something very special about our situation, which is how bad it's gotten. The World Bank shows that our government, our value for money in government expenditure has declined at the fastest rate in the world over the last 25 years. And we've, you know, there's a lot of numbers that go into that claim. It's in a report, it's 30 pages, but it's important to note that we've done extremely, extremely badly quite quickly. And I think that's partly because there's been so little pushback.
A little bit like what your former CEO at the IRR, Frans Grenier, used to say about the socialist approach of a bayonet, that you push it through the sludge until you hit steel. And that bayonet's been pushed and pushed and pushed. But how does all of this relate now to what we're seeing happening at the very top level of government, where the government of national unity is debating the budget? From what I understand, the Democratic Alliance is saying we should not be increasing taxes, even half a percentage point this year and next year on VAT. We should be cutting costs, and we should be looking at things like this BEE premium, where an elite few are literally, not literally, but figuratively, having their snouts in the trough and sucking in money from taxpayers. On the other hand, the ANC, which has a patronage network on which it relies, is studiously defending its ability to continue along the current line. So how does all of this, this BEE premium, which, as you've quantified, costs the country $150 billion, what we know of just from the state every year, how would that be related to what's going on with those budget discussions?
The DA has moved in the right direction. They have made one of their demands in the latest round of negotiations that the Public Procurement Act be amended to cut out BEE preference premiums. So that is great, because until now, it hasn't been an explicit demand. It's very good that it is an explicit demand. In my opinion, it is still too abstract. The viewers might not know this, but the laws that govern how we spend 1.2 trillion rand every year as taxpayers have changed. The triple PFA has been replaced by the PPA, but the PPA hasn't come into effect yet. So, you know, the new law's been passed, but it's still hovering, looming somewhere. And the DA wants to amend the new law that's looming. That's not very practical. It's a good thing to do, because when the new law comes, you don't want it to be so bad. But the DA should also, in my opinion, be going after the current system. And in the current system, there are two very simple ways to cut BEE premiums. The first way is to reduce the threshold. Remember, I said earlier, 50 million rand. Above it, the cap is 11%. Below it, the cap is 25%. The minister, Gordon Gwana, Enoch Gwana, he can reduce that cap, that limit, that threshold tomorrow down to 500,000 rand. So he could say everything above 500,000 rand, the cap is 11% rather than 25%. That would change the procurement game for a huge portion of that 1.2 trillion rand spent. Another thing that he can do is he can say, I will issue exemptions to all organs of state that request it. So, and then, you know, we've been encouraging organs of state to make these requests. So we think the DA is going in the right direction, but, you know, those two crisp steps would be immediate, because they would change the BEE premium game tomorrow rather than in a year whenever the new law comes to be. On the ANC side, I spoke to Secretary General Fikile Mbalula outside of Parliament when the first budget speech was collapsed. And I asked him about this issue. And, you know, he is so far from being prepared to talk about the trade-offs that he won't even countenance the publication of the numbers. So, I said, aren't you worried about this? He said, that starts politically pivoting the question by answering a different question, not the one that I asked. And then I said, okay, well, why don't you just tell me, like, what are the numbers here? Like, how much are we spending on DE premiums according to you? And where does that fit in the budget's prioritization game? We're looking for cuts. Why don't you tell us how much you think we're spending? We think it's 150 billion combining the legal and the illegal. Where do you think it is? And he said, to paraphrase, I don't think we are ready to be talking about that. I don't think people need to hear. I think the phrase he used is, rather, we should wait and see. So he doesn't think South Africans deserve to know right now how much BEE premiums cost the country. And that has been the ANC position effectively for the last 25 years, since 2000 when this law was passed, and really since 2008, which is when it started kicking into gear. 2008 is a very important date to recall in that regard, because since then, black unemployment has doubled from 5.5 million to 11.1 million. So in this BEE period, we've seen a lot of costs. We've seen disinvestment. We've seen negative impacts on the economy. And the result has been massive hardship for the nominal beneficiaries of this policy. So from the ANC's perspective, this is a very hard issue to talk about because they can't honestly say, what are the trade-offs? They can't honestly say, you know, it's worth it to be spending extra to make a millionaire even richer when the cost is what it is. So the ANC's position is to pretend that BEE premiums don't exist, to not publish the amount, and to wait and see how long will it take South Africans to demand something different. This budget crisis is that moment where finally the DA is starting to demand something different, and I think its partners as well. And I think that we'll have to see where it lands, but the hope has got to be that one of the things that comes out of this is a guarantee that they're going to be made transparent. Even if the ANC manages to hold on and say, we're still going to keep spending the money, if we make it transparent, if the ANC is forced to allow the government to officially publish in the budget, this is how much money we're spending on BEE premiums, I think that will put nails in the coffin of BEE premiums because it will allow the media, even those who are very sympathetic to BEE, to see what it's actually doing, the damage that it's actually doing. To relay that to the public, I think will trigger the beginning of the end of this policy.
It sounds a little like what's going on in the United States at the moment, where Elon Musk is driving the whole DOGE process, but he's been absolutely scrupulous in putting it all out in the public domain. You can go on there, you can see exactly where they're getting the $2 to $3 billion a day and where it's being wasted. And certainly in a South African sense, the lack of transparency has to be playing into the hands of those who want to continue. And at the BizNews conference, we had the Deputy President, Paul Mashatile, sitting with me. And I asked him a question about where did the money come from when the ANC was bankrupt one day and the next day it was ready to fight the election. Now, there are lots of people who say it came from Iran, and then they are making the relationship there directly with the ICJ case. The deputy president said that's not the case. He said the money came from South African businessmen. So now you stop and think about this for a moment. If there's 150 billion rand in BEE premiums being legally paid by taxpayers to South African businessmen who clearly have a very strong vested interest in keeping this going to the degree that they'll even bail out the ANC from its bankruptcy, we have it on the record from the deputy president where the money came from, then surely if the public were aware of this, if their eyes were opened to where this money was being, their money was being funneled, and it's not just their money, unfortunately, it's also debt that is being created on their behalf, then perhaps the public would say, whoa, we're not prepared to do this, especially given the points, the fact that you made a little earlier that the previously disadvantaged sector of the population are actually growing in unemployment. Jobs are going out the window because of this little sliver of people who are continuing with the status quo.
Yeah, I think it's very important what you say here. Let's back it up with a little research. The Institute of Race Relations last year, in its survey, asked people, would you like to cut out BEE premiums? And we gave them three options. We said, one is you keep paying the premiums. Another option is you cut it out, but you keep race as a tiebreaker. So if two companies are offering broomsticks or power transistors at exactly the same price for the same goods, then you give it to the black company, the contract. So you're preserving value for money, but you're keeping racial preference. Or third option, you cut race out completely. 70% of all respondents preferred cutting BEE premiums to zero. 66% of black respondents. That's two-thirds. And then within the ones who want to cut it, half wanted to cut it and keep race as a tiebreaker, and half wanted to cut race out completely. So there's a bit of a disagreement there, but overwhelmingly, two-thirds agree, let's get value for money first. That's what we see in the Zonda report as well. Zonda report doesn't say cut race out completely. It says get value for money first. So there does seem to be huge popular support. Another way that I can break that down for you, we ran a little bit of numbers. So we think it's 150 billion in total waste, but we think it's only 17 billion of that that's recorded legal waste. So, you know, let's just work with that small number first, and then we can think about the big number. The small number, 17 billion, what could that get you? Well, one way to think about it is it could get you a road from Cape Town to Joburg, and then you'd still have another 7 billion. And if you think about how poor our roads are and what damage that does to rural economies, I think it gives you some beginning of a picture. Here's a more important one. We calculated last year in a separate exercise how many classrooms would need to be built in the next 2 years in order for the GNU five-year cycle to achieve its goal of adding 40,000 classrooms to meet the current deficit. We would need to build 13,000 classrooms. Costs about 1.3 million rand to build a room, to build a classroom. So that adds up to 17 billion rand. So you could take the 17 billion and immediately build the classrooms that are needed to be on track to take away our classroom deficit. You go into a township, you go into a rural area where there's 40, 50, 60 kids stuffed into a classroom. You speak to the teachers, you speak to the parents, you speak to the kids, ask them whether they would like classrooms to reduce that capacity problem, or whether they'd like to keep the system where that 17 billion goes to making rich people richer. It is not going to be a very big surprise if the answer that you get is an unequivocal yes to classrooms and no to ongoing BEE premiums. So there's a very serious political argument to be made there. But I want to address one last point. What about the big businesses? Because I've debated this issue on a lot of national platforms, TV shows, radio shows, with people that are very sympathetic to BEE. And I make these points, and the pushback I get is this. Okay, Gabriel, it sounds like what you're saying is you want to take away BEE premiums, and it's good for poor black people, because poor black people will get more of a chance to get a job. But it's going to be a menial job. There's low skills. It's going to be manual labor or working at a call center, working at a shop, doing the cash register. What about the rich people? You know, we're very worried. Are you trying to say there should be less rich black people? Are you trying to take away these businesses that are creaming it at the top? Are you trying to cut those out and go back to the Guinness glass economy where it's rich whites at the foamy top and poor black people all below? And my answer to that is the following. The businesses that are currently doing very well out of the system are firstly a rainbow assortment. There's white, black, Indian, colored people milking the BEE cow. Secondly, the black businesses that have been paid BEE premiums have made trillions of rand. Treasury data shows 3.2 trillion rand has been spent on majority black-owned businesses since 2017. Trillions. So these businesses are now well-established. Thirdly, let's look at the end of apartheid. I once was part of the George Palmer Trust. He was the editor of the Financial Mail in the 70s and 80s. The argument made in the Financial Mail then, which is like the biz news of that era, was it said to apartheid businesses, look, some of you oaks are doing nicely. You think it's comfortable. You don't have to compete. You've got these walls around you. You want to keep apartheid because you're doing well out of it. You have no idea how much better you would do if you ended apartheid. Sure, you're doing well now. But if you really want to do well, end it. Because apartheid is ultimately bad for business. It's good in the short run. It's good in a narrow way. But it's restricting the market. It's alienating us from trading partners. It's limiting skills. It's limiting your access to deep capital. It's crazy for business to keep apartheid. Exactly the same argument needs to be made to black capitalists today. You think you're making money out of these 150 billion rand premiums. It's like getting the best slice of a shrinking pie. It is really not a very good idea in the middle of the long run. If you really want to make money, if you really want to add black millionaires, centimillionaires, billionaires, there's a simple formula. Liberalize the market. Let us trade. Let us be free to compete on merits. That is the formula everywhere in the world. That huge growth in wealth has occurred. That's the formula that'll work here. If you want to add black billionaires to the register, NBE. It's good for the top, it's good for the middle, it's good for the bottom. That's the the overwhelming political argument that's going to win, or else if it doesn't win, we're going to keep sliding down this road of eroding our competitive advantages, losing our infrastructure, losing our trust in democracy, losing our ability to respond to crises, and potentially eventually, you know, losing the vote, you know, losing the integrity of our country, secession, all of these kind of threats, losing property rights. It's very important to try and pivot into a growth scenario. We haven't grown since 2007. It's very, very, very hard on the country. But if we do turn that way, it's really going to be better for the vast majority, including the very established capitalists who are rent seeking at the moment and who do better to profit seek in an open market.
Yeah, all you have to do is go into the informal sector and see how innovative people are there, but they hit against a ceiling all the time. Just to close off with Gabriel, have you done any research in fronting? And I'll say this because I know a lot of people, not one or two, but numerous people who in unguarded moments will tell you, yeah, I've got this couple of black brothers who pay 20, 30,000 rand a month and they're the nominal owners of the company, but they know that I actually own the company. And the 51% that is of the shares that's in their name is just there so that they get their little bribe, and that we then continue in our business. Now, this is really distasteful and horrific. And from a national point of view, one of the uber truths that is just not ever spoken about. Do you get any in understanding of that? And I'm saying that the business people who are abusing the system are not African black, that they are of other racial groups. So have you seen any of this? Have you been able to quantify what that might, or how substantial that might be?
We haven't managed to quantify it. One thing that I'll say is that Richard Maponya, the late great Soweto retail magnate, railed against fronting. One of the things that he hated about BEE is he saw entrepreneurial spirit around him in the townships getting squashed, because he knew that as an entrepreneur, you know, it's kind of tough. It's tough making your own way. And so if there's this easy option where you can rent seek, where you can get a secure, stable, passive income that's not connected to adding value, that's just connected to a political patronage network, then unfortunately some people who would have gone on to be great business value adders would be sucked in their 20s and 30s to this more stable system and then become quite passive. The second point is, I think an author, Mr. Bishop, I can't remember his first name, wrote a book called BEE Billionaires. He was a former BBC correspondent. He went around
Chris Bishop.
He interviewed Chris Bishop. Thank you. He interviewed quite a few black capitalists to sort of see their different views. And some people were quite grateful for BEE. Some people were very critical of it. The last interview that he did was with someone who said that fronting is this terrible thing. And she'd seen quite a bit of it. And noted that it's never been prosecuted. You know, there are no major sort of court cases, although it's against the law. And I think, you know, there was something frustrating to me about that passage, because I thought, well, look, if you've got the details and you think this is a big problem, it's like, well, why aren't you giving the journalist the names why aren't you handing it over to the National Prosecuting Authority? I mean, this interview was with a lawyer associated with the Black Lawyers Association, you know, someone who's in the business of enforcing these things and who was calling for enforcement. So there's something a little bit tricky about those kinds of complaints that aren't actually met with enforcement. I think that the way that you're raising it is a bit different, though, because, you know, it's like, how do you deal with this problem? It reminds me of cigarettes being banned during lockdown. I was smoking all the time then. You know, I broke the law. I went and bought cigarettes illegally. And if someone had reported me or the seller to the police, I would have been very sad because I thought the law was crazy. So there is a kind of tricky thing when the law is so bad, do you really want to enforce it? And I think that the shame really ultimately lands on the law, not on the fronters, either on the side who's paying or the side who's receiving. Because I think what's happening here is that there is a kind of reasonable economic response to a set of policy incentives. If you set up the rules like this, it takes a huge amount of moral fortitude to have the opportunity to get 20,000 Rand and to turn it down. Or as the business owner, to see that there's this way that you can keep your business going, or else you're no longer going to get the contracts that you've been depending on. So people do take these shortcuts. They are shortcuts, though. They are ultimately like a kind of tax. They are not adding value. It's resources being reallocated in a way that doesn't add value. So I think that the deep question is this, like, where does fronting start and where does it end? You know, if you have a guy like Cyril Ramaphosa, who's sitting on the board before he's president of multiple companies, and he's worth billions because of his success in navigating the system, is that fronting or is that not fronting? A reason to say it's not fronting is the following. You'd say there's a rational economic incentive in bringing Ramaphosa onto your board, which is that it's going to facilitate your access to capital. It's going to facilitate your position in a supply chain that's advantageous. But it's exactly the same argument if you've got a small business doing curb cleaning for a municipality, and they say, we're only going to hire your business if it's half black owned, and then you bring on a black partner, you pay him 20K, and he stays quiet and doesn't really come to the board meetings. I mean, the reports say Ramaphosa would sleep through a lot of the meetings. It doesn't matter. His purpose is not to, the greatest value add that he has is to facilitate your ability to access BEE premiums. I mean, literally the scorecard for the BEE premiums, it doesn't ask, has the black person who co-owns the company made an executive decision? It doesn't ask what their opinion is. That's not the value add from a legal perspective. From a legal perspective, all that matters is, do you have someone on the board and is this their race? And how you get the money is, well, if you have someone on the board and that's their race, then you can get up to 25% extra. So the law has turned race into a commodity. You know, there's apples, there's potatoes, there's electricity, there's Bitcoin, there's rands, there's dollars. And then in South Africa, there's pigment. It's something you buy and sell. So fronting, to me, I kind of resist the notion that there's something going on some of the time and that's fronting. And then the rest of the time, no, that's real BEE. No, there's value add business where you bring someone on because you think they know how to do the business because you need money and they've got the money. Doesn't matter what race they are. A lot of the time it's going to be black guys. A lot of the time it's going to be white guys. Whatever it is, doesn't matter. On the other hand, there's this thing where you're like, here's a law. It allows me to get more money, or it stops me from getting any money, depending on what racial boxes I'm ticking. So let me tick those boxes. That's all fronting, or none of it's fronting. What it really is rent seeking in the 19th century sense of doing something that doesn't add value, but does comport with a government requirement in order to make money. So how much is fronting cost us, Alec? The short answer is 150 billion Rand a year. All of it. All of it is fronting. And the total BEE premium cost is 150 billion Rand a year.
Legally. And who knows how much. And that's legally in the state sector. Who knows about the private sector? But the point I was trying to make there was the unintended consequences of these laws are so far away from what the intentions were that it's time as a nation that South Africa, at the very least, reassesses it all. Gabriel Krauss is a fellow at the Institute for Race Relations. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.